The sound of his own voice at first calmed him. It was natural, familiar. But the hard stone walls changed his voice, so that what came back to his ears wasn't exactly what had left his lips. Close, but not the same. The monastery had twisted it, taking his words and magnifying the feelings, the fear, making his own voice grotesque. Beauvoir stepped into the small room. Like the kitchen, there was a vat bubbling away on a stove. But unlike the kitchen, this one wasn't pea soup. It smelled bitter, heavy, not a pleasant aroma at all. Beauvoir peered into the vat. Then he dipped his finger into the thick, warm liquid and smelled it. Looking around to see if anyone was watching, he put his finger into his mouth. He was relieved. It was chocolate. Dark chocolate. Beauvoir had never liked dark chocolate. It seemed unfriendly. He looked around the empty room. No, not just empty. It was abandoned. The unattended vat glugged gently, like a volcano considering whether to explode. And on the wooden counter sat small mounds of very dark chocolate, long rows of them, like tiny monks. He picked one up, turning it this way and that. Then he ate it. Armand Gamache had spent the past few minutes looking around. Perhaps the monks had hidden a key, but there was no potted palm and certainly no welcome mat to look under. It was, he had to admit, one of the strangest occurrences he'd had in the hundreds of murders his department had investigated. Granted, every homicide had its share of strange behaviour. Indeed, normal behaviour would be considered among the oddest. Still, he'd never had an entire community vanish. He'd had suspects hide. He'd had many people try to run away, but never all of them. The only monk left lay at his feet. The chief inspector hoped Frère Mathieu was still the only dead monk in the monastery of Saint-Gilbert entre les loups. Gamache gave up the search for a key and looked at his watch. It was almost 5. With a sinking heart, he slid open the slit in the door and looked out. The sun was low on the horizon, just touching the tops of the woods. He could smell the fresh air, the fragrant pine forest. But what he sought, he found. The boatman was still at the dock.
"Etienne," Gamache called, putting his mouth close to the small opening. "Monsieur Legault."
Then he looked out. The boatman hadn't moved. Gamache tried a few more times and wished he could whistle, that shrill, piercing sound some people achieved. The chief watched the boatman sitting in his boat, and he realized the man was fishing. Casting, reeling in, casting, reeling in, with endless patience. Or at least, Gamache hoped it was endless. Leaving the small slit open, he turned back to the corridor and stood very still, listening. He heard nothing. It was some comfort, he told himself, that he didn't hear an outboard motor. Still he stared, wondering where the monks were, wondering where his agents were. He pushed away the image that came into his head, created by the small but mighty factory deep within him that produced terrible thoughts. The monster under the bed, the monster in the closet, the monster in the shadows, the monster in the silence. With an effort, the chief inspector banished those horrors, let them glide right past, as though they were water and he a rock. To occupy himself, he went into the porter's room. It was really just a recess in the stone wall, with a small window to the corridor, a narrow desk, and a single wooden stool. The Spartans looked positively bourgeois next to these monks. There were no decorations, no calendars on the wall, no photos of the Pope or the Archbishop, or Christ, or the Virgin Mary. Just stone and a single thick book. Gamache could barely turn around and wondered if he'd have to back out. He was hardly petit, and when this monastery was built, the monks had been considerably smaller. It would be embarrassing if, when the others returned, they found him wedged into the porter's room. But it didn't come to that, and the chief finally sat on the stool, adjusting himself to try to find a comfortable position. His back was against one wall, his knees against the other. This was not a place for the claustrophobic. Jean-Guy, for instance, would hate it, as he himself hated heights. Everyone had something they were afraid of. Gamache picked up the old book on the narrow desk. It was heavy and bound in soft, frayed leather. There was no date written into the first pages, and the lettering was grey, faded, and written with a quill pen. The chief pulled a book of Christian meditations from his satchel, and from that he withdrew the vellum they'd found on the body, placed in the slim volume for safekeeping. Was this page torn from the huge book on his knees? He put on his reading glasses, and for what felt like the 100th time that day, Gamache examined the page. The edges, while worn, didn't appear to be torn from a larger volume. His eyes moved from the book to the page, back and forth, slowly, trying to find similarities, trying to find differences. Every now and then he looked up and down the empty corridor and listened. At this stage he wanted to see his men more than the monks. Gamache no longer bothered to look at his watch. It didn't matter. When Etienne decided to leave, Gamache couldn't stop him. But so far, no outboard motor. Gamache turned over the brittle pages of the book. It appeared to be a collection of Gregorian chants, written in Latin with the neumes above the words. A handwriting analyst could tell far more, but Gamache had examined enough letters to have some expertise. On first glance, the writing on the page and in the book seemed exactly the same, a simple form of calligraphy. Not the florid swirls of subsequent generations, these were clear, neat, graceful. But some things didn't match, tiny things, a swirl here, a tail on a letter there. The chants in the book and the one on the torn page weren't written by the same hand. He was sure of it. Gamache closed the large book and turned to the yellowed page. But now, instead of looking at the words, he examined the squiggles above them. The abbot had called them neumes, musical notations used 1,000 years ago. Before there were notes and staffs, trebles and octaves, there were neumes. But what did they mean? He wasn't sure why he was looking at them again. It wasn't as though he'd suddenly be able to understand them. As he stared, completely focused, willing the ancient markings to make sense, he imagined he heard the music. He'd listened to the recording of the monks singing their plain chant so often, the sound was imprinted on his brain. As he stared at the neumes, he could hear their soft, masculine voices. Gamache lowered the paper slowly and removed his reading glasses. He stared down the long, long, darkening corridor. And still he heard it, low, monotonous, and getting closer. Chapter 9. Gamache left the body and the book and walked swiftly toward the music. He entered the blessed chapel. The chanting was all about him now, emanating from the walls and floor and rafters, as though the building was built of neumes. The chief quickly scanned the church as he walked, his eyes sweeping into corners, rapidly absorbing everything there was to see. He was almost at the very center before he saw them, and stopped. The monks had returned. They were filing through a hole in the wall at the side of the church. Their white hoods were up, hiding their bowed heads. Their arms were across their bodies, hands buried in their flowing black sleeves. Identical. Anonymous. Not a patch of skin or hair visible. Nothing to prove they were flesh and blood. As they walked, single file, the monks sang. This was what Neum sounded like when lifted from the page. This was the world-famous choir of the Abbey of Saint-Gilbert entre les loups, singing their prayers, singing Gregorian chants. While it was a sound millions had heard, it was a sight few had ever witnessed. Indeed, as far as the chief inspector knew, this was unique. He was the first person to ever actually see the monks in their chapel singing. "Found 'em," said a voice behind Gamache. When the chief turned, Beauvoir smiled and nodded toward the altar and the monks. "No need to thank me." Beauvoir looked relieved, and Gamache smiled, relieved himself. Jean-Guy stopped beside the chief inspector and looked at his watch. 5 o'clock service.
Gamache shook his head and almost groaned. He'd been a fool. Any Quebecois who'd been born before the church fell from favour knew there was a service at 5 in the afternoon, and that any monk alive would make his way there. It didn't explain where the monks had been, but it did explain why they'd returned.
"Where's Captain Charbonneau?"
Gamache asked. "Down there." Beauvoir pointed across the chapel, through the monks, and to the far end.
"Stay here," said the chief,
and began to move in that direction when the far door opened and the Sûreté officer appeared. Charbonneau looked, thought Gamache, exactly as he must have looked when he'd arrived in the chapel. Perplexed, alert, suspicious, and finally amazed. Captain Charbonneau saw Gamache and nodded, then briskly made his way along the wall, skirting the monks but keeping his eyes on them. They were taking their places along the wooden benches, 2 rows on either side of the altar. The last man took his place. The abbot, thought Gamache. He looked like all the others, in simple robes with a rope around his slender middle, but still the chief knew it was Dom Philippe. Some mannerism, some movement— something distinguished him from the rest.
"A chief," said Charbonneau quietly when he arrived at Gamache's side.
"Where did they come from?"
"Over there,"
said Gamache, pointing off to the side.
There was no door visible, just the stone wall, and the captain looked back to Gamache, who didn't explain, couldn't explain.
"We need to get out of here," said Beauvoir. He took a step toward the monks, but the chief stopped him.
"Wait a moment."
As the abbot took his place, the singing died. The monks continued standing, absolutely motionless, facing each other. The Sûreté agent also stood, facing the monks, waiting for a signal from Gamache. He was staring at the monks, at the abbot, his eyes sharp. Then he made up his mind.
"Get the body of Frère Mathieu, please."
Beauvoir looked confused, but left with Charbonneau and returned with the stretcher. The monks remained motionless, apparently oblivious to the men standing together in the aisle, staring at them. Then the monks, in a single, synchronized movement, removed their hoods, but continued to stare straight ahead. No, Gamache realized, they weren't staring. Their eyes were closed. They were praying, silently.
"Come with me,"
Gamache whispered, and led them down the very centre of the chapel. He walked slowly. The monks, even in a trance, could not fail to hear them approaching, their feet on the floor. How disconcerting this must be for them, the chief inspector thought. Since the walls were raised more than 300 years ago, their services had been undisturbed. The same ritual, the same routine, familiar, comfortable, predictable, private. They had never heard a sound during a service they themselves had not produced. Until this very moment. The world had found them, and slipped through a crack in their thick walls, a crack produced by a crime. But Gamache knew he was not the one violating the sanctity and privacy of their lives. The murderer had done that. That vicious act in the garden this morning had summoned up a whole host of things, including a chief inspector of homicide. He took the 2 stone steps up and stood between the rows. The chief gestured to Beauvoir and Charbonneau to lower the body to the slate floor in front of the altar. Then silence again descended. Gamache studied the rows of monks to see if any of them were peeking. Sure enough, one was. The abbot's secretary, Frère Simon. His heavy face stern, even in repose, and his eyes not quite shut. This man's mind was not entirely on prayer, not entirely with God. As Gamache watched, Brother Simon's eyes closed completely. A mistake, Gamache knew. Had Frère Simon stayed as he was, Gamache might have had his suspicions, but could not have been certain. But that tiny flutter had betrayed him, as surely as if Frère Simon had screamed. Here was a community of men who communicated all day, every day. Just not with words. The smallest gesture took on a meaning and significance that would be lost in the hurly-burly of the outside world. Would be lost on him, Gamache knew, if he wasn't careful. How much had he already missed? At that moment, all the monks opened their eyes,
at once, and stared at him. Gamache suddenly felt both very exposed and a little foolish, like being caught where he shouldn't be, on the altar during a service, for instance, beside a dead man. He looked over to the abbot. Dom Philippe was the only monk not staring at him. Instead, his cool blue eyes rested on Gamache's offering. Frère Mathieu. For the next 25 minutes, the Sûreté officers sat in a pew, side by side, while the monks held vespers. They, along with the monks, sat and stood, and bowed and sat, then stood, and sat, then kneeled. "I should have carved up," murmured Beauvoir, standing again. When not silent, the monks sang their Gregorian chants. Jean-Guy Beauvoir sat back down on the hard wooden pew. He went to church as rarely as possible. Some weddings, though the Québécois now preferred to simply live together, funerals mostly, and even those were becoming rarer, at least in churches. Even the elderly Québécois, when they died, now preferred a funeral home send-off. It might not have nurtured them, the funeral home, but neither had it betrayed them. The monks had been silent for a few moments. "Please, dear Lord," Beauvoir prayed, "let this be over." Then they stood and started another chant. "Tabernac," thought Beauvoir, getting to his feet. Beside him, the chief was also standing, and resting his large hands on the wooden pew in front. His right hand trembled slightly. It was subtle, barely there, but in a man so still, so self-possessed, it was remarkable. Impossible to miss. The chief didn't bother to hide the tremor, but Beauvoir noticed Captain Charbonneau glancing at the chief, and the telltale tremble. And Beauvoir wondered if he knew the tale it told. He wanted to take him aside and scold Charbonneau for staring. He wanted to make it clear that slight quiver wasn't a sign of weakness, just the opposite. But he didn't. Taking his cue from Gamache, he said nothing.
"Jean-Guy,"
Gamache whispered, his eyes straight ahead, never leaving the monks.
"Frère Mathieu was the choir director, right?"
"Oui."
"So who's directing them now?"
Beauvoir was quiet for a moment. And now, instead of just biding his time, while this interminable, intolerable, tedious chanting droned on and on, he started to pay attention. There was an obvious empty spot on the benches, directly across from the abbot. That must have been where the man now laid at their feet had stood, and sat, had bowed and prayed, and led the choir in these dull chants. Beauvoir had earlier amused himself by wondering if the prior had possibly done it to himself, stoned himself to death rather than have to live through yet another mind-numbing mass. It was all the inspector could do not to run shrieking into one of the stone columns, hoping to knock himself out. But now he had a puzzle to occupy his active mind. It was a good question. Who was leading this choir of men, now that their director was dead?
"Maybe no one is," he whispered, after studying the monks for a minute or two. "They must know the songs by heart. Don't they do the same ones over and over?"
They sure sounded the same to him. Gamache shook his head.
"I don't think so. I think they change from Mass to Mass and from day to day. Feast days, saints' days, that sort of thing."
"Don't you mean et cetera?" Beauvoir saw the chief smile slightly and shoot him a glance.
"And so on," said Gamache. "Ad infinitum."
"That's better." Beauvoir paused before whispering.
"Do you know what you're talking about?" "I know a little, but not much," admitted the chief. "I know enough about choirs to know they don't direct themselves, any more than a symphony orchestra can conduct itself, no matter how often they perform a work. They still need their leader."
"Isn't the abbot their leader?" asked Beauvoir, watching Dom Philippe. The chief also watched the tall, slender man. Who really led these monks, both men wondered, as they bowed and sat again. Who was leading them now? The Angelus bell rang out, its deep, rich notes pealing over the trees and across the lake. Vespers was over.
The monks bowed to the crucifix and filed back off the altar, while Gamache and the others stood in their pew and watched.
"Should I get the key off that young monk?" Beauvoir waved to Friar Luke, who was leaving the altar.
"In a moment, Jean-Guy."
"But the boatman?"
"If he hasn't left by now, he'll still be waiting."
"How do you know?"
"Because he'll be curious,"
said Gamache, studying the monks.
"Wouldn't you wait?"
They watched the monks leave the altar and pool on either side of the church. "Yes," thought Beauvoir, shooting a glance at the chief. "I'd wait." With their hoods down and heads up, Gamache could see their faces. Some looked as though they'd been crying. Some looked wary, some weary and anxious. Some just looked interested, as though they were watching a play. It was difficult for Gamache to trust what he was sensing from these men. So many strong emotions masqueraded as something else. Anxiety could look like guilt. Relief could look like amusement. Grief, deep felt and inconsolable, often looked like nothing at all. The deepest passions could appear dispassionate, the face a smooth plane, while something mammoth roiled away underneath. The chief scanned the faces and came back to two. The young gatekeeper who'd met them at the dock, Friar Luke. Gamache could see the large key dangling from the rope about his waist. Luke looked the most blank, and yet that morning he'd clearly been very upset. Then Gamache turned his gaze on the abbot's glum secretary, Brother Simon. Sadness. Waves of it washed off the man. Not guilt, not sorrow, not wrath or mourning, no eerie or iller, but pure sadness. Brother Simon was staring at the altar, at the two men still there, the prior and the abbot. Who was this profound sadness for? Which man? Or, the chief wondered, maybe it was for the monastery itself, a sadness that Saint-Gilbert entre les loups had lost more than a man. It had lost its way. Dom Philippe paused before the large wooden cross and bowed deeply. He was alone now on the raised altar, except for the body of his prior, his friend. The abbot held his bow. Was it longer, Gamache wondered, than usual? Was the effort of getting back up, of turning around, of facing the evening, the next day, the next year, the rest of life, too much? Was the gravity too much? Slowly the abbot raised himself to a standing position. He even seemed to square his shoulders, standing as tall as he could. Then he turned and saw something he'd never seen before. People in the pews. The abbot had no idea why there were even pews in the blessed chapel. They'd been there when he'd arrived 40 years earlier, and they'd be there long after he was buried. He'd never questioned why a cloistered order needed pews. In his pocket, Dom Philippe felt the rosary beads, his fingers running over them without conscious thought. They offered a comfort that he also never questioned.
"Chief Inspector," he said, as he stepped off the altar and approached the men.
"Dom Philippe,"
Gamache bowed slightly.
"I'm afraid we're going to have to take him away now."
Gamache gestured toward the prior, then turned and nodded to Beauvoir.
"I understand," said Dom Philippe, though he privately realized he understood none of this. "Follow me."
Dom Philippe signaled Frère Luc, who hurried over, and the three men made for the corridor that led to the locked door. Beauvoir and Captain Charbonneau followed, carrying the stretcher with Frère Mathieu. Beauvoir heard something behind him, a shuffling, and looked. The monks had formed two rows and were following them like a long black tail.
"We tried to find you earlier, Père Abbé," said the chief, "but couldn't." "Where were you?"
"In chapter."
"And where is chapter?"
"It's both a place and an event, Chief Inspector. The room is just over there."
The abbot waved toward the wall of the blessed chapel just as they walked through the door and into the long corridor.
"I saw you coming out of there," said Gamache. "But when we looked earlier, we didn't find a door."
No. It's behind a plaque commemorating Saint-Gilbert."
"It's a hidden door?"
The abbot, even in profile, looked puzzled and a little surprised by the question.
"Not from us," he finally said. "Everyone knows it's there. It's no secret."
"Then why not just have a door?"
"Because anyone who needs to know about it does," he said, not looking at Gamache, but looking toward the closed door ahead of them. "And anyone who doesn't need to know should not find it."
"So it is meant to be hidden,"
said Gamache, pressing the point. "The option is meant to be there," admitted the abbot. They'd arrived at the locked door to the outside world. He finally turned to look directly at Gamache. "If we need to hide, the room exists."
"But why would you need to hide?"
The abbot smiled a little.
"It was just this side of condescending.
I'd have thought you, of all people, would know why, Chief Inspector. It's because the world is not always kind. We all need a safe place sometimes."
"And yet the threat, finally, didn't come from the world," said Gamache.
"True."
Gamache considered for a moment.
"So you concealed the door to your chapter room in the wall of the chapel?"
"I didn't put it there. All this was done long before I came. The men who built the monastery did it. It was a different time, a brutal time, when monks really did need to hide."
Gamache nodded and looked at the thick wooden door in front of them, the gateway to the outside world, that was still locked even after the passage of centuries. He knew the abbot was right. Back when the massive tree was cut down for this door hundreds of years ago, it wasn't tradition but necessity that turned the key in the lock. The Reformation, the Inquisition, the internecine battles, it was a dangerous time to be a Catholic, and, as with recent events, the threat often came from within. And so, in Europe, priests' holes were built into homes, tunnels dug for escape. Some had escaped so far they popped up in the New World. And even that wasn't far enough. The Gilbertines had gone even further. They disappeared into the blank spot on the map. Vanished. To reappear more than 300 years later on the radio. The voices of an order everyone had thought was extinct were heard first by a few, then by hundreds, then by thousands and hundreds of thousands. Then, thanks to the Internet, finally millions of people listened to the odd little recording of monks chanting. The recording had become a sensation. Suddenly their Gregorian chants were everywhere, a de rigueur, deemed a must-listen by the intelligentsia, the cognoscenti, and finally by the masses. While their voices were everywhere, the monks themselves were nowhere to be seen. Eventually they'd been found. Gamache remembered his own astonishment when it was discovered where the monks lived. He'd assumed it was some remote hilltop in Italy, or France, or Spain, some tiny, ancient, crumbling monastery. But no. The recording was made by an order of monks living right there, in Quebec. And it wasn't just any order. The Trappists, the Benedictines, the Dominicans. No. Their discovery seemed to astonish even the Catholic Church. The recording had been made by an order of monks the Church seemed to think had died out. The Gilbertine. But there they were, in the wilderness, on the shores of this far-flung lake, very much alive, and singing chants so ancient and so beautiful they awakened something primal in millions worldwide. The world had come calling, some curious, some desperate for the peace these men seemed to have found. But this gate, made from trees felled hundreds of years ago, held firm. It did not open for strangers. Until today. It had opened to let them in, and now it was about to open again, to let them out. The portier came forward, the large black key in his hand. At a small sign from the abbot, he inserted it in the lock. It turned easily, and the door swung open. Through the rectangle, the men saw the setting sun, its reds and oranges reflected in the calm, fresh lake. The forests now were dark, and birds swooped low over the water, calling to each other. But by far the most glorious sight was the oil-stained boatman, smoking a cigarette and sitting on the dock. Fishing. He waved as the door swung open, and the chief inspector waved back. Then the boatman struggled to his feet,
his considerable bottom all but mooning the monks. Gamache motioned Beauvoir and Charbonneau with the body to leave first. Then he and the abbot followed them to the dock. The rest of the monks stayed inside, clustered around the open door, craning to see out. The abbot tipped his head to the red-streaked sky and closed his eyes. Not in prayer, Gamache thought, but in a sort of bliss, enjoying the meagre light on his pale face, enjoying the pine-scented air, enjoying his feet on the uneven, unpredictable ground. Then his eyes opened. "Thank you for not interrupting Vespers," he said, not looking at Gamache, but continuing to soak in the natural world around him.
"You're welcome."
They took a few more steps. "Thank you, too, for bringing Mathieu to the altar."
"You're welcome."
"I don't know if you realized it, but it gave us a chance to offer special prayers for the dead."
"I wasn't sure," admitted the chief inspector, also looking ahead at the mirror lake. "But I thought I heard Dies Iri."
The abbot nodded.
"And Dies Illa."
"Day of wrath, day of mourning."
"Are the monks mourning?" asked Gamache.
Their gait had slowed almost to a halt. The chief had expected an immediate answer, a shocked reply. But instead the abbot seemed to consider. "Mathieu wasn't always an easy man." He smiled a little as he spoke. "No one is, I suppose. One thing we learn early when committing to a monastic life is that we have to accept each other."
"And what happens if you don't?"
The abbot paused again. It had been a simple question, but Gamache could see the answer wasn't simple. "That can be very bad," said the abbot. He didn't meet Gamache's eyes. "It happens. But we learn to set aside our own feelings for the greater good. We learn to get along."
"But not necessarily to like each other," said Gamache. It wasn't a question. He knew the Sûreté was much the same. There were a few colleagues he didn't like, and he knew the feeling was mutual. Indeed, didn't like was a euphemism. The feeling had gone from disagreement to dislike to distrust, and was growing still. It had settled, for now, on mutual loathing. Gamache didn't know where it would stop, but he could imagine. The fact these people were his superiors made it simply more uncomfortable. It meant, at least for now, they had to figure out how to exist together. Either that, or tear each other and the service apart. And Gamache, as he tilted his own face to the glorious sunset, knew that was a possibility. In the calm of the early evening, it seemed far away. But he knew this peaceful time wouldn't last. Night was coming, and it was a fool who met it unprepared. "Who could have done this, mon père?"
Now they were stopped on the dock, watching as the boatmen and the officers secured Frère Mathieu's covered body to the boat, beside the catch of bass and trout and the writhing worms. Again the abbot considered. "I don't know. I should know, but I don't." He looked behind him. The monks had ventured out and were standing in a semicircle, watching them. Frère Simon, the abbot's secretary, was standing a step or two forward.
"Poor one," said Dom Philippe under his breath.
"Who do you mean?"
"Pardon?"
"You said, poor one. Who did you mean?"
asked Gamache.
"Whoever did this."
"And who is that, Dom Philippe?"
He'd had the impression the abbot had been looking at one monk as he'd spoken. Brother Simon, the sad monk, the one who'd separated himself from the rest. There was a moment's tense silence as the abbot looked at his community and Gamache looked at the abbot. Finally the abbot turned back to the chief inspector.
"I don't know who killed Mathieu."
He shook his head. A weary smile appeared on the abbot's face. "I actually believed I could look at them just now and tell, that there'd be something different about him, or me, that I just know." The abbot gave a small grunt of laughter. "Ego. Hubris."
"And?"
asked Gamache. "It didn't work."
"I don't feel badly. I do the same thing. I have yet to look at anyone and know immediately that they're the killer, but I still try."
And what would you do if it worked?
I'm sorry?
Suppose you did look at someone and just knew.
Gamache smiled. I'm not sure I'd trust myself. Probably think it was all in my imagination. Besides, it wouldn't impress a judge if on the stand I said, I just knew.
That's the difference between us, Chief Inspector. You need proof in your line of work. I don't.
The abbot glanced behind them again, and Gamache wondered if this was idle conversation or something more.
The semicircle of monks continued to watch. One of them had killed Brother Mathieu.
What are you looking for, mon père? You might not need proof, but you need a sign. What sign in their faces are you looking for? Guilt?
The abbot shook his head. I wasn't looking for guilt. I was looking for pain. Can you imagine the pain he must have been in to do this? And the pain he still feels?
The chief scanned their faces again and finally came to rest on the man right beside him. Gamache did see pain in the face of one of the monks, Dom Philippe, the abbot.
Do you know who did this?
Gamache asked again, quietly, so that it was only audible to the abbot and the sweet autumn air around them.
If you do, you must tell me. I'll find him eventually, you know. It's what I do. But it's a terrible, terrible process. You have no idea what's about to be unleashed. And once it starts, it won't stop until the murderer is found. If you can spare the innocent, I'm begging you to do it. Tell me who did this, if you know.
That brought the abbot's full attention back to the large, quiet man in front of him. The slight breeze tugged at the graying hair just curling by the chief inspector's ears. But the rest of the man was still, firm. And his eyes, deep brown like the earth, were thoughtful and kind. And Dom Philippe believed Armand Gamache. The chief inspector had been brought to the monastery, admitted to their abbey, to find the murderer. It was what this man was always meant to do, and he was almost certainly very good at it.
I would tell you if I knew.
We're ready, Beauvoir called from the boat.
Bon.
Gamache held the abbot's eyes for another moment, then turned to see the boatman's large hand resting on the outboard motor, ready to pull the cord.
Captain Charbonneau?
Gamache invited the Sûreté inspector to take a seat.
Is it possible to keep this quiet? Asked Dom Philippe.
I'm afraid not, mon père. The news will get out, it always does, said Gamache. You might consider issuing a statement yourself.
He saw the distaste on the abbot's face and suspected that wouldn't happen.
Au revoir, Chief Inspector, said Dom Philippe, extending his hand. Thank you for your help.
You're welcome, said Gamache, taking the hand. But it isn't over yet.
At a nod from Gamache, the boatman yanked the cord and the motor leaped into life. Beauvoir dropped the rope into the boat and it drifted away, leaving Gamache and Beauvoir standing on the dock.
You're staying? Asked the abbot, bewildered.
Yes, we're staying. I leave with the murderer or not at all.
Beauvoir stood beside Gamache, and together they watched the small boat chug down the sunset bay and around the corner, out of sight. The two Sûreté investigators remained there until the sound had disappeared. And then they turned their backs on the natural world and followed the robed figures back into the monastery of Saint-Gilbert entre les loups.
Chapter 10
Beauvoir spent the early evening setting up their incident room in the prior's study, while Chief Inspector Gamache read the interviews with the monks and spoke to some in more depth. A picture was emerging. How accurate it was impossible to say, but it was clear and surprisingly consistent from man to man. After vigils at 5 in the morning, the monks had had breakfast and prepared for the day. There was another service at 7:30, Lord's. It ended at 8:15. Then their work day began. Work was any number of things, but for each man it was much the same each day. They worked in the garden or with the animals. They cleaned the abbey, did the archives, did repairs, cooked the meals.
Each man was, it turned out, quite expert in his field, whether it was as a chef or gardener, engineer or historian. And they were all, without exception, exceptional musicians.
"How does this happen, Jean-Guy?"
Gamache asked, looking up from his notes.
"That they're all remarkable musicians."
"You're asking me?" Beauvoir's voice came from beneath the desk, where he was trying to reconnect the laptop. "Dumb luck?"
"A dumb luck would be you getting that thing to work,"
said the chief.
"I think there's another agency at work here."
"I hope you don't mean divine."
"Not entirely, though I wouldn't rule it out."
"No, I think they must have been recruited." Beauvoir looked out from beneath the desk, his dark hair disheveled.
"Like hockey players are recruited?" "Like you were recruited. I found you lording it over the evidence locker in that Sûreté outpost, remember?"
Beauvoir would never forget. Banished to the basement because no one wanted to work with him. Not because he was incompetent, but because he was an asshole. Though Beauvoir preferred to believe they were just jealous of him. He'd been assigned to the evidence locker since he was only fit for things not actually alive. They'd wanted him to quit, expected him to quit. And, to be honest, he'd been about to quit when Chief Inspector Gamache had come calling on a murder investigation. He'd come to the locker looking for a piece of evidence, and found Agent Jean-Guy Beauvoir, and had invited him to join the investigation. It was a moment Beauvoir would never forget, looking into those eyes, a smart-ass remark dying on his lips. He'd been fucked with so often, jerked around, insulted, bullied. He barely dared hope this wasn't another trick, a new bit of cruelty, kicking a dead man, because Beauvoir could feel himself dying down there. All he'd ever wanted was to be a Sûreté officer, and every day he came closer to losing it. But now this large man with the quiet demeanour had offered to take him away, to save him, even though they were strangers. And Agent Beauvoir, who had sworn never to trust again, had trusted Armand Gamache. That was 15 years ago. Had these monks also been recruited? Found? Saved even? And brought here? So, said Beauvoir, getting up from the floor and dusting off his slacks. You think someone lured these monks to the abbey? Gamache smiled and looked at Beauvoir over the top of his reading glasses.
You have a gift for making everything sound suspicious, even ominous.
Merci. Beauvoir sat down with a thump on one of the hard wooden chairs.
Does it work?
Gamache nodded toward the laptop. Beauvoir pressed some buttons. The laptop works, but we can't connect to the internet. Beauvoir continued to pound the connect button as though that would help.
Perhaps you should pray, suggested the chief.
If I was going to pray for anything, it'd be food. He gave up trying to connect. When's dinner, do you think? Then Beauvoir remembered something and brought a small wax paper packet from his pocket. He placed it on the desk between them and opened it up.
What are those?
Asked the chief, leaning closer. Try one. Gamache picked up a chocolate and held it between his large fingers. It looked microscopic there. Then he ate it, and Beauvoir smiled to see the astonishment and delight on Gamache's face.
A blueberry?
Beauvoir nodded. Those tiny wild ones, chocolate-covered. They make them by the bucket-load here. I found the chocolatier when I was looking for the monks. Seems like the better find. Gamache laughed, and together they ate the few chocolates. They were, the chief had to admit, without a doubt the best he'd ever tasted, and he'd tasted a few chocolates in his life.
What are the chances, Jean-Guy, that all 2 dozen monks here, all of them, would have good voices?
Pretty small.
And not just good voices, but great voices. And ones that work together, that fit together.
Maybe they were trained, suggested Beauvoir. Isn't that what the choir director, the dead man, would have done?
But he had to have something to work with. I'm far from an expert on music, but even I know a great choir isn't just a collection of great voices. They have to be the right voices, complementary, harmonious. Now I think these monks are here by design.
I think they were specially chosen to sing the chants."
"Maybe they were specially bred for this," said Beauvoir, his voice low and his eyes mock mad. "Maybe this is some Vatican plot. Maybe there's some mind control in the music, to lure people back to the church, produce a zombie army."
"Oh my God, man, that's brilliant. It's so obvious."
Gamache looked at Beauvoir with awe. Beauvoir laughed. "You think the monks were specially chosen?"
"I think it's a possibility."
The chief got to his feet.
Keep working at that. It would be nice to be able to contact the outside world. I'm going to speak to the portier."
"Why him?" asked Beauvoir, as Gamache made for the door.
"He's the youngest here. Probably the most recent arrival."
"And a murder happens because something changes," said Beauvoir. "Something provoked the murder of Frère Mathieu."
"It was almost certainly building for a while. Most murders take years to actually happen. But finally something, or someone, tips the balance."
That was what Gamache and his team did. They sieved for that often tiny event, a word, a look, a slight. That final wound that released the monster. Something had made a man into a murderer, had made a monk into a murderer, surely a longer journey than most.
"And what was the most recent change?" asked Gamache. "Perhaps the arrival of Frère Luc. Maybe that somehow upset the balance, the harmony of the abbey."
The chief closed the door behind him, and Beauvoir went back to work. As he tried to figure out what was wrong with the connection, his mind went back to the evidence locker. His hell. But he also thought about the door with the word "porterie" stamped on it, and the young man relegated to it. Was he hated? Surely you had to be stuck there. Every other job made sense in the abbey, except his. After all, why have a porter for a door that never opened?
Gamache walked through the halls, meeting a monk here and there. He was beginning to recognize them, though he couldn't yet put names to all the faces. Frère Alphonse, Frère Félicien. The monks' faces were almost always in repose, their hands thrust up their drooping sleeves, in a mannerism the chief realized was just something monks did. When he passed, they always caught his eye and nodded. Some ventured small smiles. All looked, at a distance, calm, contained. But up close, at that moment when they passed, to a man Gamache saw anxiety in their eyes, a plea. For him to leave? To stay? To help? Or to go away? When he'd arrived, not that many hours ago, the Abbey of Saint-Gilbert had seemed peaceful, restful. It was surprisingly beautiful. Its austere walls not cold, but soothing. The daylight refracted by the imperfect glass, broken into reds and purples and yellows. Apart they made individual colours, but together they made giddy light. Like the abbey, made up of individuals. Alone they were no doubt exceptional, but together they were brilliant. Except for one, the shadow. Necessary, perhaps, to prove the light. Gamache approached another monk as he made his way through the blessed chapel. Frère Timothée, Frère Guillaume. They passed and nodded, and again Gamache caught something in this anonymous monk's passing glance. Perhaps each man had a private plea, different from the rest, depending who he was and what was his nature. This man, Frère Joël, clearly wanted Gamache to go away, not because the monk was afraid, but because Gamache had become a walking billboard advertising the murder of the prior, and their failure as a community. They were supposed to do only one thing, serve God. But instead, this abbey had gone in the opposite direction, and Gamache was the exclamation mark that drove that truth home. The chief turned right and walked down the long corridor toward the closed door. He was growing familiar with the abbey, comfortable even. It was in the form of a cross, with the blessed chapel in the middle and arms out four sides. It was now dark outside. The halls were dimly lit. It felt like midnight, but when he glanced at his watch, the chief saw it wasn't yet 6:30. The door marked porterie was closed. Gamache knocked and waited. Inside he heard a small sound, a paper, a page turned,
then silence again.
"I know you're in there, Frère Luc," said Gamache, lowering his voice, trying to make himself sound less like the big bad wolf. He heard more paper shuffling, and then the door opened. Frère Luc was young, in his early 20s, perhaps.
"Oui?"
the monk asked, and Gamache realized it was the first time he'd heard this boy speak directly to him. Even in that short word, Gamache could hear that Frère Luc's voice was full and rich, a lovely tenor almost certainly. While the man was reedy, the voice was not.
"May we talk?"
Gamache asked. His own voice was deeper than this boy's. Frère Luc's brown eyes flicked this way and that over Gamache's shoulder.
"I believe we're alone," said the chief.
"Oui," he repeated, folding his hands in front of him. It was a parody of the composure of the other monks. There was no calm here. This young man seemed torn between being afraid of Gamache and being relieved to see him, wanting him to both leave and stay.
"I've already been interviewed, monsieur."
It was, even in simple speech, a beautiful voice, a shame to hide it in a vow of silence.
"I know," said Gamache. "I read the report. You were here when Frère Mathieu was found."
Luc nodded.
"Do you sing?" the chief asked.
In any other setting, it would be a preposterous first question to a suspect, but not here.
"We all do." "How long have you been at Saint-Gilbert-Entre-les-Loups?"
10 months. There was a hesitation, and Gamache felt this young man could have told him the days, hours, and exact minutes since he'd walked past that heavy door.
"Why did you come here?"
"The music." Gamache didn't know if Frère Luc was being deliberately unhelpful by giving terse answers, or if the rule of silence came naturally to him and words did not.
"I wonder if you could be a little fuller in your answers, mon frère."
Frère Luc looked petulant. A young man trying to hide a temper beneath monk's robes, thought Gamache. So much can hide in silence, or at least try. Gamache knew most emotions eventually found their way out, especially anger.
"I'd heard the recording," said Luc, "the chants. I was a postulant in another monastery, down south, by the border. They also do chants, but this was different."
"How?"
"It's hard to say what's different."
Frère Luc's face changed as soon as he thought about the music. That calm he'd only pretended to became genuine. "As soon as I heard the monks from Saint-Gilbert, I knew I'd never heard anything like it."
Luc actually smiled. "I suppose I should say I came here to be closer to God. But the truth is, I think I can find God in any abbey, but I can't find the chance just anywhere, only here."
"The death of Frère Mathieu must be a great loss." The boy opened his mouth, then shut it. His chin dimpled just a bit, his emotions almost breaking through.
"You have no idea."
And Gamache suspected that might be right.
"Was the prior one of the reasons you came here?"
Frère Luc nodded.
"Will you stay?" Gamache asked.
Frère Luc dropped his eyes to his hands and kneaded his robe.
"I'm not sure where else I'd go."
"This is your home now?"
"The chants are my home. They happen to be here."
"The music means that much to you?" Frère Luc cocked his head to one side and examined the chief inspector.
"Have you ever been in love?"
"I have," said Gamache. "I still am."
"Then you'll understand. When I heard that first recording, I fell in love. One of the monks at my old monastery had a recording. This was a couple of years ago, when it first came out. He came into my cell and played it for me. We were both in the choir at the abbey, and he wanted to know what I thought."
"And what did you think?"
"Nothing. For the first time in my life I had no thoughts, just feelings. I listened to the recording over and over in all my spare time."
"What did it do for you?"
"What did falling in love do for you? Can you ever really explain it? It filled empty spaces I never knew were empty. It cured a loneliness I never knew I had. It gave me joy and freedom. I think that was the most amazing part. I suddenly felt both embraced and freed at the same time."
"Is that ecstasy?" Gamache asked, after thinking about what the monk had said for a few moments.
Was it a spiritual experience?
Again, Frère Luc regarded the chief inspector.
It wasn't having a spiritual experience. I'd had them before. We all have here, otherwise we wouldn't be monks. This was the spiritual experience, completely separate from religion, from the church.
What do you mean?
I met God.
Gamache let that sit for a moment.
In the music?
He asked. Frère Luc nodded, lost for words.
Jean-Guy stared at the laptop screensaver, then at the portable satellite dish they took with them into remote areas. Sometimes it worked, sometimes it didn't. Why it would work and why it would fail were mysteries to Beauvoir. He made the same connections every time, made the same adjustments, did the same thing at every investigation, then waited for the inexplicable to happen. Or not.
Merde,
he mumbled. Still, all was not completely lost. He had his BlackBerry. Opening the door to the prior's office, he looked out. No one coming. Then he sat and, using his thumbs, laboriously typed a message. Where once his emails had been single words and symbols, now they were whole sentences. He wrote you instead of you. He never used the punctuation for a smile or a wink, preferring to make it clear in language how he felt. It wasn't hard. With Annie, his feelings were always clear and very simple. He was happy. He loved her. He missed her. Besides, even had he wanted to use contractions and symbols, none had yet been invented to convey his feelings. Even words couldn't do it. But they were the best Jean-Guy had. Every letter, every space brought him closer to her, and gave him not just pleasure, but joy. Annie would see what he'd created for her. What he'd written. He loved her, he wrote. He missed her, he wrote. And she wrote to him, not simply in reply, but her own messages, about her day, so full, but still empty, without him. She was having dinner with her mother, but would wait until he and her father returned so they could tell them together. Hurry home, she wrote. I miss you, she wrote. I love you, she wrote. And he felt her presence. And he felt her absence.
So you came to the monastery of Saint-Gilbert, said Gamache.
Well, that's the short version, said Frère Luc. Nothing with the church is ever short. He was relaxed, but having, with that question, strayed slightly from the discussion of music, Luc appeared to grow more guarded.
And the long version?
It actually took a while to find out who'd produced the recording. I thought they must have been an order somewhere in Europe.
And even so, you'd have been willing to go there?
If the woman you loved lived in France, would you have gone? Gamache laughed. The young monk had got him, a direct and accurate hit.
My wife, said the chief, and I'd have gone to hell to get her.
I hope that wasn't necessary.
Well, Hochelaga Maisonneuve.
But you had to search? All I had was the CD, but it doesn't say anything on it. I have it in my cell still, somewhere. Gamache had the CD. He'd bought it over a year ago. And he, too, had searched for the liner notes to find out who the monks were. But there were none, just a list of the chants. The CD cover showed simply monks in profile, walking. It was stylized, seeming at once very abstract and very traditional. There were no credits. The CD didn't even have a name. It looked, and was, amateurish, the sound echoey and tinny.
So how did you find out who it was?
Like everyone else, I found out on the radio, when those reporters tracked them down. I couldn't believe it. Everyone in my monastery was shocked, and not just because they were Québécois, but mostly because they were Gilbertine. They're not listed among the living orders. According to church records, they died out or were killed off 400 years ago. There are no more Gilbertine monasteries, or so everyone thought.
But how did you come to join them?
Gamache persisted. He could get the history lesson later.
Father Abbot visited my monastery and heard me sing.
Frère Luc suddenly looked quite bashful.
"Go on," said Gamache.
"Well, I have an unusual singing voice, a strange timbre."
"And what effect does that have?"
"It means I can sing with virtually any choir and fit in."
"You harmonize well?"
"We sing in plain chant, which means we all sing the same note at the same time, but with different voices. We don't actually harmonize, but we need to be in harmony when we sing." Gamache thought about that distinction for a moment, then nodded.
"I am the harmony."
It was such an extraordinary thing to say that the chief merely stared at this young monk with the simple robes and a grandiose statement.
"Pardon, I don't understand what that means."
"Don't get me wrong. The choir doesn't need me. The CD proves that."
"Then what did you mean?"
It seemed to the chief a little late for humility. "Any choir would be better with me in it." The two men stared at each other. It now struck Gamache that this might not be pride or bragging. It might be a simple statement of fact. Just as monks might learn to accept their failings, maybe they also learn to accept their gifts, and not pretend, for the sake of a false humility, not to have them. This man didn't hide his gift, and yet he did hide his voice, in a vow of silence, in a monastery far, far away from people, from an audience.
"Unless... so, you weren't on this first disc?"
Luke shook his head.
"But there were more recordings planned?"
Frère Luc paused.
"Oui. Frère Mathieu was excited about it. He had all the pieces chosen."
Gamache pulled the paper from his satchel.
"Is this one of them?"
Luke took it from the chief. He was totally focused, completely still. His brows drew together, and he shook his head, handing the paper back.
"I can't tell you what this is, monsieur, but I can tell you what it isn't. It's not a Gregorian chant." "How can you tell?"
Luke smiled. "There are very clear rules to a chant, like a sonnet or haiku, things you must do and things you mustn't. A Gregorian chant is about discipline and simplicity, the humility to submit to the rules and the inspiration to rise above them. The challenge is to use the rules and transcend them at the same time, to sing to God and not impose your own ego. That," he gestured to the paper, now back in Gamache's hand, "is nonsense."
"You mean the words?"
"I don't understand the words. What I mean is the rhythm, the meter. It's way off, too fast, not even close to a Gregorian chant."
"But it has these things."
Gamache pointed to the squiggles above the words.
"Neumes, right?"
"Right. That's what's so troubling about it."
"Troubling, Frère Luc?"
"It's meant to look like a Gregorian chant. It's masquerading as one. But it's an imposter." "Where did you find it?"
"On the body of Frère Mathieu."
Luc blanched. Gamache knew that there were two things a person could not create, no matter how much they willed it. A blanch and a blush.
"What does that tell you, Frère Luc?"
"That the prior died trying to protect what he loved."
"This?"
Gamache lifted the page. "No, not that at all. He must have taken that from someone here, someone who was trying to turn the chants into a joke, trying to make them an abomination, and the prior wanted to stop it."
"You think this was done as an insult?"
"Someone knew Gregorian chants and neumes enough to mock them. Yes, it was done on purpose, as an insult."
"Someone here, you said?"
"Who?" Gamache watched the young monk. Frère Luc was quiet. Gamache waited. Then he spoke, recognizing that sometimes silence was a useful tactic, much more oppressive and threatening than hurled insults. But here silence was their comfort. It was the spoken word that seemed to frighten the monks.
"Who hated Frère Mathieu enough to mock his life's work?"
Gamache persisted.
"Who hated him enough to kill him?"
Luc remained silent.
"If every monk here loves the chants, why would one mock them, create what you call an abomination?"
Gamache held the vellum up and leaned forward very slightly. Luc backed away very slightly, but he had nowhere to go.
"I don't know," said Luc. "I'd tell you if I did. The chief studied Frère Luc, and thought he probably would. He loved the chance, and clearly admired and respected the prior. Frère Luc would not protect any man who was out to kill both. But while this monk might not know who did it, he might have suspicions. As the abbot had said earlier, Gamache needed proof, but a monk only needed his beliefs. Did Frère Luc believe he knew who'd killed the prior and mocked the chance? And was he arrogant enough to think he could deal with them on his own? The chief inspector held the monk's eyes, and when he spoke his voice was stern.
You must help me find out who did this.
I don't know anything.
But you suspect?
No, that's not true. A murderer is walking these halls, young man. A killer is trapped in here with us.
With you.
Gamache saw the fear in Luke's eyes. A young man who sat alone all day, the only key to the outside world attached to a rope around his waist. The only way out was through him. If the murderer ever wanted to escape, it might literally be over this young man's dead body. Did Luke appreciate that? The chief inspector leaned away, but not by much.
Tell me what you know.
All I know is that not everyone was happy about the recording.
The new one? The one the prior was about to make?
Frère Luc paused, then shook his head.
The old one? The first one?
Frère Luc nodded.
Who was unhappy?
Now Frère Luc looked miserable.
You must tell me, son, said Gamache.
Luc leaned forward to whisper, his eyes darting into the dim corridor. Gamache also leaned forward to hear. But before he could say anything, Frère Luc's eyes widened.
There you are, Monsieur Gamache. Your inspector said you'd be here. I've come to take you to dinner.
Frère Simon, the abbot's secretary, stood in the hallway a few feet from the porter's door, his hands up his sleeves, his head humbly bowed. Had he heard their conversation, Gamache wondered. This was the monk whose eyes never seemed to quite close, who watched everything, and who, Gamache suspected, heard everything. Chapter 11. Two monks came out of the kitchens, carrying bowls of small new potatoes drizzled with butter and chives. A broccoli and sweet squash and casseroles followed. Cutting boards with warm baguettes dotted the long refectory table, and platters of cheeses and butter were silently passed up and down the long benches of monks. The monks, though, took very little, passing the bowls and bread, but only taking enough to be symbolic. They had no appetite. This left Beauvoir in a quandary. He wanted to drop huge spoonfuls of everything onto his plate until he could no longer see above it. He wanted to make an altar of the food, then eat it, all. When the first casserole, a fragrant cheese and leek dish with a crunchy crumble top, came by, he paused, looking at the modest demands everyone